Let me just again welcome people and say that today's session is focused on right concentration, which is to me an interesting and sort of ironic topic in this time of the pandemic, because I don't know about anybody else, but I have noticed that the climate that we're living in is a challenge to concentration. And that I sometimes feel kind of scattered, even though I'm sheltering in place. My mind seems to be all over the place. So I have actually been using the practice of concentration to help me both in finding some inner ease and grounding and centering, and also to help me regather my attention amidst this sense of scatter that I tend to feel, like what day of the week is it and what am I supposed to do next? And I'm back to living by lists and, you know, I've got a calendar, but I also write it down and, you know. So concentration does seem like a wise cultivation for us right now. You're saying thumbs up, huh? Okay. So I'd like to go ahead and begin for us with a sit. And just as a context, in addition to us thinking about the broader societal context and what's going on in terms of the pandemic and so on, let's also recall, with that sense of change and impermanence in our hearts and our minds, that this is our last session together as the Insight Santa Cruz Cultivating the Path group. We have one more get together with our Redwood City colleagues, although I'm sure it will be virtual, on June 13th for a final day long. However, for our portion of this process, the time has passed and we're coming toward an ending. And I hold that with some sense of satisfaction and poignancy. And I just invite us all to hold that awareness as part of our experience today, along with our intentions for why we started this class series and our intentions as we close this portion of it. So I've got my little bell, my little portable one. It's not as good as the big one at the center, but it'll do. So as that sound of the bell spreads virtually to all the places in which we all are physically located, we can come together in our intention to use the next 15 minutes for a time of grounding and settling that prepares our hearts and minds to truly be with each other and these teachings of the path. And beginning, as we always do, with a grounding of our bodies. Feeling beneath us the surface that we're sitting on, however our feet meet the ground. Savoring this contact as in a sense an embrace of the earth that holds us, allowing us to let go of the weight of our bodies in these places of meeting the earth, and let ourselves be supported literally by the earth beneath us. just as our practice supports us. And as we feel into those spaces of grounding in the lower portion of our bodies, we can also be aware of the uplift of the torso. Finding this balance as we begin our practice helps us, in a sense, to embody the balance that we seek in our practice. We are grounded and uplifted. We are relaxed and alert, awakened, letting our bodies personify that sense of balance in our practice. Sitting, as one teacher notes, like a mountain that natural dignity and steadiness of a mountain. And as a way to really arrive in this sense of presence, I invite us also to become aware of the body in a short body scan. Simply gives us a way to begin focusing our attention. And this time, begin with noting any sensations in the area of the scalp. It's not an area we often pay much attention to. Beginning at the hairline near the forehead and scanning backwards. It's not necessary to feel actual sensations as much as awareness of the presence, the quality of the scalp. Skin, the bones, the flesh, feeling back to that soft spot at the top of the skull, down into the area where the skull meets the neck. Feeling how the head is balanced on the neck. And around into the area of the jawbone. Letting that connection relax, feeling into the area of the mouth, the chin. Again, softening up into the area of the cheeks, the nostrils, perhaps feeling the breath entering there or at the mouth. And then up into the area of the eyes, the forehead. Many of us, our eyes are closed, and yet we can still note movement, perhaps colors, light. The forehead softened. And scanning back down the face to wherever the breath enters the body for each of us. From that point of entry, noting the breath moving down the throat, feeling the lift of the shoulders, the collarbone, chest, and the settling back down with each exhale. Inviting ourselves to note this experience of the body breathing in the upper portion of the chest in some detail. Feeling the interconnection of the lift of the chest and its settling with the movement of the shoulders, the collarbone, the upper back. And then shifting attention to note how this symphony of movement also includes the rib cage. Expanding with each inhale. Softening and settling back down with each exhale. Noting this movement not only in the front of the body, but in the back and the sides as well. And then down into the area of the stomach. Expanding out from the rib cage. Again, this dance of conjoined movements as the diaphragm lifts. And settles with each expansion and contraction of the stomach. Back portion of the body as well, the sides. Perhaps feeling contact with the inner arms. Down into the lower belly. Again, this dance of expansion and settling. Reaching around to the lower back. Held within the hips. perhaps some light pressure down into the seat, the pelvic area. And then noting the weight of our thighs, wherever our legs are settled. Perhaps our hands located on the thighs or the belly. Feeling the point of contact of the hands with some other portion of our body. Noting that sensation felt in both portions of the body. The bend of our knees, allowing the angling of the legs to shift. Down into the calves, the shin bones. Feeling the solidity of this area of the body. And down into the feet, wherever they rest in contact with the surface beneath us. Feeling the buzz of sensations in this sensitive part of our body. And now widening the lens of our attention as we close. Have a felt sense of the whole body. Breathing, feeling, connecting. And now as the bell is ready to ring, dedicating our settling, our awareness, our presence to the practice of this path for our own well-being, for however we share this well-being with others. Namaste. So Bill will begin with the first half of our talk. And just again, as a context for folks, we are planning to wrap up by 3:30 like we did last month and to have one breakout session. This small, that'll be easy to sort of divide us up. It's almost like one group, huh, Bill?
Almost.
Yeah. So, Bill, would you like us on mute while you talk or whatever?
I mean, I'm okay with taking questions, you know, during the talk. So,
okay.
Yeah, up to you guys. Just raise your hand or something. wave at me if you have a question.
Yeah, and if your dog starts barking or your cat starts howling or your kids come to grab you, we can let you put mute on. Yeah, life happens. Go ahead, Bill.
All right, so great to see everyone. So Leslie invited me in to help teach this particular section of the Eightfold Path. I think because we both share a kind of a passion for wise concentration. We've both been on many retreats. I have to say it's my primary practice for many, many years. So it's I'm just happy to be able to, kind of share my experience, in this particular area of the Dharma. So this section is really talking about concentration from a somewhat traditional Dharma perspective. Just kind of give you kind of a fuller picture. You probably heard a number of the terms that I'm going to be talking about and some of the concepts, but maybe never in a coherent frame, which is what I'm going to try to present. So first, I'd like to start off with kind of definitions of various terms that you may have heard. And by the way, Leslie, I'd be happy to share my notes if we get the email addresses of folks. Okay. So you don't have to scribble, write down real fast. Of course, it's going to be a recording of this, so you always go back to that. Anyway, so one term that you're going to run into in this arena is called samadhi. And it actually tends to translate as concentration, but I don't think that's necessarily the most accurate. I think, from a traditional Pali perspective, it also can really mean something like to bring together or to go back on track, in its literal translation. I think it's probably most appropriate translation is indistractability. It's just the ability of the mind to really come to a state where it's difficult to be distracted. So it's very one-pointed. And we create conditions to allow this to arise by removing obstacles. It's not something that we can easily create by the will. It's more of a kind of letting go into an experience to let it happen. Another term we're going to run into is samantha. Now, this actually translates as the word calm. It really refers to any type of meditation practice that calms the mind and would lead to samadhi. Now, you probably heard the term jhana, kicked around. And jhana actually literally translates as meditation. But it's really been much more associated with these kind of different levels of samadhi. And these higher levels of jhana are just higher levels of concentration or undistractability. So you'll actually see these three terms, samadhi, samantha, and jhana, kind of used interchangeably, all referring to it's the same kind of basic notion that the mind becomes very one-pointed, still in meditation or experience. There's a couple other terms that you'll hear. One is piti, P-I-T-I. And this translates to something like rapture, ecstasy, delight. And in this way, it's actually referring to the physical body experience, of this kind of ecstasy or happiness or rapture. It's not the mental side, it's the physical side. There's another term called sukha, which more refers to the mental side of the experience of the jhanas and translates as happiness or joy. But again, it's really oriented to the mental side of the equation. So hopefully that helps you kind of weave through all this various material that you'll see when referring to, concentration. Now, historically, you'll actually see many references to concentration or jhana, you know, in many places in the suttas. So it's really in the background of, you know, lots of different parts of the Pali Canon. And I think part of what happened here is that it wasn't, you know, this super dominant aspect of it, but it was pretty much assumed at the time of the Buddha, you know, that you understood that these concentration practices were a very important part of the meditative path. It was kind of assumed. In fact, the Buddha's initial teachers, you know, he, you know, left the palace and started wandering. The first couple of teachers that he worked with, who were very well known in India, they were experts, you know, at teaching concentration. And in fact, those teachers were so impressed with the capabilities of the Buddha to enter these different concentration states that they invited him to teach with them at different points. But it's interesting because the Buddha definitely benefited, you know, from his experiences of concentration or jhana. And he really felt that it was part of the path of wisdom overall and the movement to the cessation of dukkha. So the really the fulfilling of the Four Noble Truths. But where his teachers felt it was kind of an end in and of itself, you know, these concentration states, the Buddha saw that as just part of a path to liberating insight. So it was fuel, you know, for moving in this particular direction. In fact, it is said that Buddha resided in the fourth jhana at his death. So that's an interesting perspective, you know, how it fit into his world. So you might ask, what's the relationship then of concentration to mindfulness? Because I believe that was the previous path factor, right, Leslie? Yeah, was mindfulness. And really the correct answer to that is that they're this really integrated two parts of basically the same path. In other words, it isn't skillful concentration without mindfulness, and it's not mindfulness without concentration. You know, so they really support each other is one way to look at it. Now, what are some of the benefits of concentration per se? It definitely kind of cultivates a very deep experience of happiness. It's really unconditioned, you know, by the world around you or, you know, the situation that you're in. You can touch into this kind of well of happiness inside of you. It creates a stability of mind. You know, the speed bumps of life, you know, you have kind of a less of a direct effect on you. You can just move through these things much easier. Also creating equanimity and kind of a sense of internal peace. I think you have to be kind of careful about, and I think this is one of the reasons that you didn't see many of the initial teachers, you know, in our tradition talk about concentration or jhana, is that you can become kind of attached to it. You know, it's not an uncommon experience. You have these experiences and then immediately your mind says, I want to go back there all the time. So it gets, it can get kind of hooked. One of the things about a concentrated mind that's really helpful is it's an excellent reflector. So it can create kind of a mirror of whatever's placed before it. So you're able to just experience things for what they are, is another way to put it, which I think is part of its great benefit when you really are working with insight practices and you're having insights. You're just able to experience life for what it is. Actually, wise concentration in the suttas, if you dig in far enough, is very often defined as the first four jhanas. So that those first four steps of the jhanic experiences lead to wise concentration. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, what those are and what's past the, what's the fifth jhana, et cetera. So this notion of concentration is something that's not typically achieved all at once. It isn't like one day you're sitting there and all of a sudden, whoop, okay, all these, four or eight jhanas just appear. It usually takes a fair amount of practice and it develops in stages. In fact, a number of teachers I've talked to, think that you pretty much have to be on extended retreats, before you can kind of get into a still enough state to experience these different stages. But the nice thing is that even though concentration is really beneficial for developing liberating insight of some kind, it's not necessarily required. I know in my own life, I've had liberating insights outside of jhana states, and I know people that have lots of liberating insights without, necessarily being in these states. So they're not required, but they are helpful. Okay. So any questions so far? No? Okay. All right. Okay, I'd like to talk now about kind of these stages, one of these different levels of concentration or jhanas. And the first one I want to talk about is called access concentration. Now, it's interesting because this particular term is not defined in the suttas themselves, in the Pali Canon. It's more defined in the commentaries that happened after the lifetime of the Buddha. And you can think of it as kind of an early jhana state or pre-jhana state. That I think people started noticing, after the time of the Buddha. And it directly relates to the experience of kind of fully being with your meditation object. In other words, your mind is really getting pretty absorbed into whatever your meditation object is. Now, we tend to focus on this point in the evolution of the Dharma on three objects. The breath, metta, and body sweeping. Those three objects predominate, but there are other objects that you could use. In fact, I think there's about 30 of them in the suttas. Now, one aspect of access concentration is that the hindrances, the classic hindrances, have kind of faded into the background, and you're really able to rest more on your meditation object. And access concentration can kind of vary between kind of a temporary concentration, like all of a sudden it appears and then kind of fades away, to something that's kind of stronger, it's more persistent, over time. So access concentration then can lead into the classic four jhanas, initial four jhanas. Now, these are called the material jhanas. I don't know why, but that's what they're called, the suttas. Now, the first jhana, there's both a sense of both piti and sukha. So there's both a physical and there's a mental kind of joy or rapture kind of suffusing the body. But thoughts remain. There's still thoughts happening, but you're having this kind of simultaneous experience, of feeling this kind of sense of joy in the body and the mind. But the mind's also still kind of maybe busy doing some other things. But kind of more in the background, that this happiness, this physical, mental joy is, kind of more dominant. And it tends not to be very calm per se. So there's lots of kind of physical energy in the body Now, by the way, as we describe these jhanas, they tend to be experiences that are, you know, kind of in within each other. You know, think of those, what are those Russian dolls, you know, where you one is inside of the other. That's a way to think of these jhanic states. You know, you pass through one and it kind of, it's a narrowing down into the next one. So in the second jhana, the thinking aspect, the thoughts, you know, tend to, you know, more fade into the background and around maybe occasionally, but they're definitely disappearing. And there's more internal kind of tranquility happening. So the pitti is kind of subsiding and it's more sukha. It's starting to become more dominant. So there's more mental joy. As one teacher described, it's an upwelling of happiness, like a cool spring filling a lake. What's happening? Now, as you transition into the third jhana, the pitti itself, the physical aspect of it, has pretty much disappeared. And the sukha kind of moves into this more feeling of kind of satisfaction, you know, or what's called wishlessness, you know, just in this serene kind of state. Kind of more of a sense of contentment with kind of life and experience. It is said the smile of the Buddha comes from the third jhana. Now, as you transition into the fourth jhana, this is where this quiet stillness just predominates. You know, the mind has really settled. There's no more pity. There's no physical aspect to this. There's a deep sense of equanimity. And in my own experience, it's like my mind has stopped and I can experience that. It's just, it's very comfortable and just this, you know, like maybe still hovering state, you know, it's very pleasant, you know, but really distinct in that the mind isn't going off somewhere. It's just stopped. It also can feel like this deep letting go, so dropping down into like this deep kind of cave or well. You have more kind of an isolated cocoon feeling. So your physical sensations are kind of disappearing, like this, like sound and the sense of touch, and even the feeling of your body tends to kind of disappear. It said actually that the fourth jhana then is a real good base, you know, for actually then starting formal insight practice. Okay, any quick questions? At those, yeah, go ahead, Megan.
Hi. I'm just curious. I've been a Zen student for years and years, so this is. I've only been doing like a physical practice for about 8 months. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when I've been on retreats that I've gone through these four stages and then kind of come back and then start again and come back, and like sometimes it'll be more intense than the last time. So this isn't a life progression. This is a meditation progression.
Over and over.
And each time brings a little more awareness.
Yes.
Is that okay? Thank you.
Yeah. And it can
and
be.
I just want to point out, Bill, if we're really going to stick with our schedule, probably not much time for the formless jhanas.
Yeah, I wasn't going to.
Okay. Because we got, supposedly we move on at 2:20.
2:20. Okay. Yeah. I'm just going to mention a few more, a couple things, but okay. That's the predominance of it. Okay. Yeah, just Megan. So it is something that you just keep returning to. In fact, it's, you know, it just migrates over time. Yeah. And there's lots of, I mean, this is really a very high level description, but I know people have lots of different experiences as they go through this. Okay, real quickly, there are, officially, you know, four more jhanas, the four higher jhanas, the immaterial or formless jhanas. I'll just mention them. There's books written that I'm going to refer to that if you're curious, you can dig in a little deeper. But at this point, you're trying to put into words experiences that are very difficult to bring to words. So you read this and go, this, I'm not sure this makes any sense. That's because it's hard to describe. So the next four jhanas are the realm of infinite space, the realm of limitless consciousness, the realm of no thingness, and then the realm of perception, non-perception. So it gets pretty crazy, is my conclusion, you know, out there. I've talked to teachers about some of my experiences in these realms, and it's pretty hard to kind of pin down. So just to let them know that they're there. And there's other descriptions in the commentaries of other types of jhanic experiences that are, they're different than these. So it can go off in a lot of different directions. There are a number of different teachers out there that have written a lot about this that I've run into. A guy named Lee Brasington wrote a book called Right Concentration. A guy named Ajahn Brahm, who studied with Cornfield's monastery. Who was that? Ajahn Chah. I studied with Ajahn Chah. Mindfulness, Bliss, and Beyond. It's a great book. A couple of local teachers, Shyla Catherine over in the South Bay, wrote a book called Focused and Fearless. And our own Richard Schenkman, who used to practice with us in Santa Cruz, wrote a book called Experiencing of Samadhi. And there's another teacher, Bhante G, Beyond Mindfulness in Plain English. It's mostly about concentration. So there's lots of interesting books to read if you're really curious about this. I'd say Lee Brasington's Right Concentration is probably the best in my view. Of course, he's an engineer and I'm an engineer, so we think the same. Okay, so that's pretty much it.
Just to add one comment, just as a sort of an irony, Lee lives in the East Bay too. So our Bay Area is home to three of the world's leading concentration practice teachers. It sort of says something about California and the Bay Area probably, but.
We're crazy.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think this was time for breakout sessions. How many folks? 2, 4, 6, 7. Okay. So there's a function in Zoom that's pretty cool. It's called breakout sessions. And what I can do is I'll create a couple of two breakout sessions and it'll randomly place you guys in those sessions. And we'll go for about 20 minutes. And let me tell you what the question is to work with. You guys will have to time yourselves, you know, kind of moving between, you know, groups. You each have about maybe 5 minutes or so. So the question to contemplate in your breakout session is describe a time that you naturally experienced a calm and collected mind. Because this notion of concentration in jhana can actually occur spontaneously. And how did this impact you? So again, it's describe a time that you naturally experienced a calm and collected mind, and how did it impact you? I think I'll type this out also and put it in the chat.
I was putting it in. I gotcha.
Okay. All right, so bear with me while I set up the breakout room. So I think we have about 5 minutes here for any comments that came out of the breakout session.
Or, any questions that might have arisen or any observations you all could share between the couple of groups? Maybe group one, somebody just say a little bit like what it was like.
Nicole? Nicole's got her hands up. Turn on your mic. Turn your mic, Nicole.
There you go. I'll just say that in our group, we all got in touch with nature. And it seemed like that was the number one pull to allow us to ease our mind, free our mind, let go of concerns, worries, and just be in the moment with the joy. And it's such a sweet feeling. And talk about the level of concentration we can get into when we really are paying attention to our environment. So that was indicative of all of us.
Yeah, not an unusual experience at all. I think a lot of people I know that that's one of the first experiences they would have of the sense of flow, you know, which is a level of kind of concentration mm-hmm. is in nature or in it or like athletic activities.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Our other group, somebody give us a sense of kind of what the nature of your dialogue was.
We spoke of more of specifically meditation experiences. Some very intense, others in nature, others the opposite of concentration, of being very distractive and learning how to pull back into a more concentrated, focused state. So we ran the gamut.
Practicing in a sense with the hindrances, mm-hmm. which is an important part of cultivating a wise concentration practice, to know when we're in that state of agitation and distraction.
Right.
And use that awareness as a call, a mindfulness bell, as you said, to pull back. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Any questions or particular challenges come up that people want to share? Because you're probably not alone with them. Well, one of the challenges that can come up with Zoom meetings, particularly ones that go on this long, is the need for a break and getting to the bathroom, et cetera, et cetera. So we're going to now take a 10-minute break. We'll be back at 2:55 for a short second talk. And then we'll just close with an open time for a few questions and be done by 3:30. So if you want to stop your video or whatever it takes to go do whatever you need to do to be comfortable, we've got a 10-minute break now. Well, in the interest of allowing us to finish by our stated time and perhaps at least get out and savor a walk on this beautiful day, even if we're not doing much more to experience that nature support we were talking about, I will go ahead and get started. I'll start with just a little bit of humor. Bill and I have connected beautifully over our shared interest in concentration practices, and we laugh about the fact that our connection is illustrative of the range of what concentration practice can mean for people, because as Bill said, he's an engineer and kind of a geek, and I'm the, you know, the touchy-feely people person who had a career in human services. And in a sense, our concentration practice truly encompasses the both and of those different realms that we've chosen to focus on in some respects in terms of how we've spent our time. And we found this beautiful common ground in terms of the practice benefits for us, the life benefits and path benefits of a concentration practice. And so I want to speak a little bit more from building on that beautiful solid foundation of the Dharma teachings and the systematization of concentration practice that Bill gave us such a beautiful overview of, to look at that in terms of the two kind of different dimensions that broaden the view a little bit. One is our everyday lives and how we apply concentration, which is not beneficial simply in the sense of having beautiful experiences sitting on the cushion, but also in the context of the overall path, acknowledging, as I said, that we're wrapping up our examination and our reflection on the whole path, as Gregory Kramer says, and that the role of concentration is really in the totality of this whole path, which, as the people who are in my mentee groups probably get tired of hearing me say, is not a linear path. It's an interdependent collection of insights and practices that create a more holistic experience for us. So looking at a little further at that role of concentration in the overall path, most commentators see that interwoven nature in the elements of the path, their interdependence, and they're in a sense, my hands going because I'm so visual, they form what we could call a virtuous cycle. As we develop more of a wise view, we can relate to establishing wise intention, which perhaps helps to feed wise action, wise livelihood, wise speech. And all of that gives us the grounding for our mindfulness, which connects so naturally to our concentration. And it goes on around again in that the deeper practice of concentration has helped me to hold a wiser view, one that isn't just a matter of memorizing some things I might have heard in a talk or read, but really feeling the truth of that view of interdependence, impermanence, non-self, the truth of the need for intention to be aligned in that direct way with our actions, for that sense of the wisdom of action, livelihood, and speech with concentration to be even more deeply grounded for us. That virtuous cycle, in a sense, is called by some commentators a threefold training. And probably you've already heard this, gotten this sense of it, but those threefold segments, the initial one, the wisdom or prajna segment, where we're looking at view and intention, the sila or ethics section, where we look at action, speech, livelihood, and the samadhi or concentration section, which involves our wise effort, mindfulness, and that beautiful word that Bill used for us, samadhi, concentration. So those qualities of wisdom, ethical behavior, and the focusing and undistractability of our minds are all interconnected. And we can feel that interdependence in how we practice concentration. Imagine sitting down to practice concentration and you've been involved in some behavior that might be considered unwise, unethical. It's going to be distracting you like crazy. The fight you were in, the way you mouthed off at somebody, whatever, is going to rile you up in a way where you're still completing that conversation or you're wondering, uh-oh, am I going to get in trouble for what I did or whatever. It's going to be really hard without that ethical grounding to really begin to settle in to that sense of non-distractibility of concentration. And that steadiness of concentration helps guide our intention and our view, as I said. And all of it begins to help us develop that wisdom element of view and intention. All of it, in a sense, circling around and around in a spiral that, as one teacher describes, transcends and includes. So we begin to see our path as more of that positive cycle than as a path, and we've gotten to the culmination of it in concentration. There is, I think, an especially close connection between these two elements of the path that are described in this last segment of samadhi, concentration, mindfulness and concentration. As Bill said, the two have to be integrated because it isn't all about just attaining the jhanas. They are fun. But we have a different intention, in a sense, in our concentration practice. And that is liberation and deepening our wisdom, seeing through appearances, finding peace within what's true of our world. I think you had this same perspective and the same kind of quote, Bill. It's not really wise concentration unless mindfulness is also present. And by the time we get to those later states of the four jhanas, there is a sense of mindfulness coexisting with the concentration. When we're in that quiet stillness, that sense of equanimity, that letting go and dropping down, there's a way that that calmness and steadiness lets us develop a super deep mindfulness practice. And when you watch that arising and passing of the breath or sounds or whatever you may have been focusing on, you're getting it, that it's not staying the same. It's changing. You're getting it that you and everyone else in the room are breathing the same air and are interdependent. There's this sense of becoming aware in a mindful way of a very deep sort of wisdom about the characteristics of existence. And samadhi, in a sense, wise concentration, then becomes a part of cultivating liberation, cultivating liberating insight, which is really what the whole path is about. It's said that you can begin with either mindfulness or concentration practice as you're focusing in the elements of the path. I think there are some teachers, Lee Brazington, whom Bill mentioned, is one who actually sees a real value to concentration practice to actually turbocharge our mindfulness and insight practice. And that has absolutely been my experience. I don't know. Would you say similarly, Bill? Yeah?
Yes, I would. Yeah. Sorry, I was on mute.
Yeah. So that sense of fuel from concentration practice, feeding mindfulness, and then the two coming together, sati and samadhi, that mindfulness and concentration, to give us this kind of liberating insight. And the qualities of the two in some ways are a both and that fits together really, really well. The experience, Bhante Gunaratana calls it a mental balancing act as we cultivate the qualities of sati and samadhi. Samadhi is a kind of strength and force in a sense, not force in a negative way, but that strong quality. And sati is more flexible and sensitive, kind of the softer and the firmer side of our practice, mindfulness and concentration. But when we put them together, we get the value of that both and we need both of them for that liberating insight. I think I'm someone who thinks in visual terms and concrete terms. So when I was thinking about that both and, that quality of them coming together, I was looking outside at the decking outside my door here, and I thought it works as a firm foundation because it has both these long, strong boards and these cross beams. They're stronger together. It wouldn't work to just have them going one way. So we bring together our mindfulness and our concentration like good builders put together foundations, decking, whatever, through the different angling of the materials. Or for some of us who may be more familiar with weaving and tapestries, the weaving of a cloth gains its strength from those threads coming together. And in a sense, we weave together our concentration and mindfulness, and both of them together help us to weave together this whole web of the path. And from that, a kind of equanimity and calm balance in our lives can be cultivated that gives us tastes of a real sense of liberation, of freedom. It's interesting. I've had enough practice in this area, and I know, Bill, you have, because we've done so much of it together. But I find that it's also a bit like we combine these qualities and they become embodied in a way that's probably in a sense of classic form of conditioning. I simply talk about these practices, that equanimity and that calm balance, and I can feel it in my chest. That recollection, that bringing together of past experience has made it easier for me to attain those states. So in terms of our practice, what I want to say for the last segment of what I want to talk about is how we cultivate all this in a funny way. It makes me think now, kind of poignantly, about my going to the gym nearly every day. I didn't do it simply to show off, you know, how many reps I could do or how much weight or whatever. I did it because the practice, the strength that I developed, kind of comparable to the concentration practice, allowed me to come back into my everyday life with capacities that felt good and that allowed me to live in a different way, more aware of my movements to be safe and healthy, able to be the old lady at the office who could actually lift the water bottle into the dispenser. Able to use that strength in other ways. And so I think in a sense, as you seek to cultivate a wise concentration practice, remembering an intention that's based on more than becoming an Olympic concentration practitioner, but of living a life that feels healthier and more comfortable, that has that kind of balance that my gym practice gives me. And what happens is over time, in that almost conditioned way, you begin to be able to reach those states far more readily and to soften up the edges to connect them up with that weave with the rest of our path more readily. One of my favorite practices, and it certainly is now one of the ones I'm going to a lot, is what are called the Brahma Viharas, the four heart practices: loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity. I find that a concentration practice as a beginning place helps me to reach those states. The calmness that I feel opens me in a sense of safety and calm balance and grounding to experiencing that larger view that can take in the suffering of others or rejoice in something wonderful that happens to them or hold that sense of equanimity. So I've found a really strong connection between my heart practices and my concentration practice. And in fact, when Bill and I were at a 2-week retreat with Lee Brazington a couple of years ago, Lee was asking me about my experiences. And I said, strangest thing is happening. I'm going from access concentration right into the second or third jhana. And I'm not in that kind of jangly space of PT and Sukha, which are nice, but they can also be kind of, woo, a little much. I'm not in them. I'm going straight into that calmer state. And he said, by any chance, are you doing metta practice as your access concentration practice? Are you doing loving kindness practice? And I said, yeah, I am. He said, that's why. That smooths that entry. And you can actually begin with the higher jhanas from that beginning place. So I started realizing these two are really interconnected. And so one suggestion I would make is those of you who like those heart practices, it's not just about following the breath or the body. The repetition of phrases in a loving kindness practice is a beautiful form of access concentration practice and can lead very naturally into experiencing that move from access concentration to the four jhanas. So I would also say the other ingredient that I would strongly recommend, the other helpful quality, is patience. This is not something you do once and you go, oh, click, I got it now. I can do that over and over again. For me, again, my gym practice is a good reminder. It takes a while to build up that muscle. And if I stop practicing concentration, the muscle can fade away. Same thing that I experience at the gym. It's why I'm doing weights here by myself at home, because I don't want to go through that return to the gym being miserable. The patience to allow the buildup of that concentration strength and then the right effort to sustain that are really, really important. One more thing that I would say before wrapping up my comments about what I think is helpful for practice and the challenges we can run into. Again, with that kind of Olympic concentration model in mind, you can think, all right, I'm going to get to the fourth jhana the first day, and have that real craving for achievement, super hindrance. One of the forms of wisdom that Lee conveys is don't enter these practices with expectations or a scorecard, a benchmark for yourself. Just come in and be with intention and some degree of just awareness of where we are, rather than that unrealistic sort of craving for achievement that can create tremendous hindrances for us. Greed, basically. Ooh, I want to get to the fourth jhana. Or, ooh, that buzz of piti and sukha feels wonderful. I think I'll just stay there. I will tell you one funny story to wrap up, because I'm feeling in a somewhat humorous mood today, and it is Mother's Day. The first time I went on a 2-week concentration retreat with Lee Brasington, I had done concentration as a short practice. I'd not done anything. I think it was 10 days, not 2 weeks. I had not done anything that long. I really dropped in. I really experienced it. Lee is a good teacher. I came home, my kids were like early teen and mid teenagers. And they said, how was your retreat, Mom? And I laughed and said, guys, don't ever bother with drugs. I got something cheap and legal, and it feels even better. And they laughed at me, and I had to let go of my attachments to experiencing that high again. And I was laughing about it, and it's part of my letting go. But this is a practice that is rewarding, both in that calm and groundedness and in the way in which it brings greater connection for us to the rest of our practice. So we have a moment or two for any questions and closing. And Bill, you had a quote I think you wanted to make sure we closed with. So any questions, any comments people have as we close? Unmute yourself and come on back. Bill, can you unmute folks?
They can unmute themselves. I think I can unmute them too.
Okay. All right. Everybody's back. Good. So any questions or comments? Here's some other voices. I could interpret that as no, it all made perfect sense, or no, I'm completely distracted and have no idea what you're talking about. So
I have a question here. So,
sure.
So what would be to cultivate concentration, you know, here it's like, you know, you could focus on the breath or like a metta practice. Mm-hmm. And that's just, as you get concentrated, then that's when you reach the jhana states?
First, what's called access concentration. And as Bill said, Lee's book, Right Concentration, is a beautiful way of presenting a framework that shows this initial state of access concentration, which kind of just gets us settled enough and undistracted enough that we're fully with whatever we've been focusing on. And from that initial concentration, we begin to be able to move into these other states. And usually sequentially, my experience of skipping the first jhana is an unusual one. But the access concentration state is really important. And then there are ways that teachers define kind of how you move from access concentration to opening to the experiences of the jhanas. One of the things where attachment can get in the way is if you're in a too big a hurry to get to the jhanas, you don't stay steady long enough in access concentration.
And then it's just kind of a natural progression.
Mm-hmm.
As you maintain concentration, and you just kind of, and then it's just something that you just notice as it's happening or after the fact or something.
Yeah, and there are ways in which once you feel that you have sustained that access concentration for a long enough period of time, you can shift into a different quality of practice that encourages the jhanas. Bill, you want to say anything about that?
You know, I was always reminded of something that Liu said many times, which was, the jhanas come find you.
Yeah. Perfect.
I thought that was a big piece of wisdom.
When you're doing access concentration and you're staying steady with that one-pointedness, suddenly there'll be this buzz in your chest.
It's a supreme letting go.
Yeah, gradually there'll be this buzz. And if you don't go grabbing for it and say, oh, damn, great, I'm in the first jhana, you know, you're okay. They come find you, as you said, Bill.
Yeah, I think it's Ajahn Brahm likes to talk about. It's a supreme letting go. And what you're observationally experiencing this stuff happen. And it's not an act of the will. Okay, we're going to go here today.
Mm-hmm.
Work that way.
Yeah, so that's part of that clinging. That's one of the hindrances, is that sense of control and clinging.
Kind of set the conditions, right? You take yourself into a quiet place, you practice, you know, you start to practice whatever the object you're going to use, and then it's like, okay, it's going to go where it's going to go.
For those of you who may have more practice of compassion or loving kindness, for me there's a parallel. We don't say those phrases like we're actually going to make those things happen, like a prayer or something. It's simply a way of opening our hearts. And at a certain point, something begins to feel different. And that tender-heartedness that may hold someone suffering in a particular way has been aroused by the repetition of those phrases. We didn't do it like magic or control. We just let compassion find us.
Yeah. I had a question.
Yeah, Megan.
I have been feeling this sensation for the past few months now when I sit, and it's when my thoughts drop away, and the word I can use to describe it is compression. It feels like something is pushing down on the top of my head. My throat starts getting constricted. My chest gets constricted. And if I let it run its course, my whole body starts curling up and like really clenching. And there used to be, if I would just let it run its course, there used to be a release. But for the past 2 months, there's just simply no release, and my breath gets really, really short, and until it gets so tight and I can't breathe, and the only way it lets go is because I have to get air. So I'll breathe in and let it go, but then when I do that, I lose my concentration. So when I don't concentrate so deeply, it doesn't happen as much. I can still feel it there. I can feel it in my head and I can feel it in my chest, but the compression doesn't happen if I kind of really lightly concentrate, and I can feel like the tingling on my skin. I can feel that, and then I can feel like the energy outside, but But then it's very distracting at the same time. So is that, should I stay there and just work on the balance of those two?
Bill, you looked like you were going to say something.
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
I'm still kind of processing what she's saying. I haven't heard that before coming from a student. So, Leslie?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think what you describe as that balancing is important. And there also may be, in a sense, not a craving kind of hindrance, but a fearful one. Because once you had that one time and you get little tinglings of certain sensations, it would be completely natural to have that begin to amp up that contraction. And I think you're backing off a little bit and softening and just staying with a lighter sense of concentration is a skillful way to proceed right now.
It's when I do that, then there's just constant thinking as well.
And this is something maybe to talk at more length if you have a mentor or whatever rather than today, or we can follow up if you want. But I think there's a generous metta for self way of holding that process with awareness.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we're at 3:30. So I just want to say, if anyone has follow-up questions, concerns, anything comes up, please feel free to get in touch with us or with your mentor. And Bill, I have your notes, same ones that you had before that
yes.
I could send to folks. And that's enough logistics. I start to get uptight like Megan was talking about when we talk about too many logistics. Does that work okay for you, Bill?
That's fine.
All right. Well, thank you all, and may all of us be well. May we find that grounding and that calm balance, and may that be to the benefit of those in our world who are so in need of that now. Namaste.
Namaste.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.